Okay, good evening, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to the fifth lecture of Mini Science 2009 to Infinity and Beyond. I'm not Martin Grant. My name is Peter Gruder, and I'm Associate Dean of Research and Graduate Education, Faculty of Science, and I'm actually also a physics prof here in this building, not on the infinitely large. I work in the field of infinitely small in nanoscience. So last week, Professor Andrew Cummings gave you a lecture entitled In Search of New Worlds, the Discovery and Characterization of Exoplanets. And just in case you weren't there, and I can tell you in two or three lines what you missed, essentially, Professor Cummings described the recent revolution in our understanding of planetary systems with the birth of the field of exoplanets. He described techniques used to find these planets and to characterize their properties. And he also described the properties of the 346 planets that were discovered up to last Wednesday or Thursday, essentially. So it's an ongoing discovery process. So if you want to know more about it, or you know, if you want to find out the answer to the questions from last week, visit our new blog at mcgill.ca/science, where you'll find the answers to the following questions from last week. What causes planets to be different in size, composition, orbit, and other properties? Can we detect and measure the different types of revolutions of these planets, how fast they rotate and how they rotate? What is the temperature range of hot planets? And are the temperatures on a hot planet fairly constant, or does it change? So if you want to know the answer to those questions, visit blogs.mcgill.ca/science. On that blog, you'll also find the answers to the questions of the previous mini-science lectures, as well as other blog items that might be of interest. Okay. So I guess we're moving on to the next part, which is essentially the quiz. And so question one. How are the masses and the radii of exoplanets measured? Say it again?
Variations in length of the stars which they rotate about.
Correct. So that's how you can measure the radius. And how do you measure the mass, how heavy they are? Yeah. I heard correct. So essentially it's the amplitude of the oscillation of the star which tells you is proportional to the mass of the planet pulling on the star. Good. So question two. Name a surprising property of exoplanets when compared to the planets in this solar system here, in our solar system. What is different about them? They're large, really big, yep. And maybe some other properties which are very different from our planets? Yeah, the orbits are different. In what respect? Their eccentricity is hugely different from our planets, or our planets are so, which essentially go more or less around in circles. I mean, they're ellipses, but very close to circles. Very impressive. So I'll go on to question three, the last one. What do gas giant planets and neutron stars have in common? These huge gas planets that one discovered, what do they have in common with neutron stars?
Very dense core.
Yep. So I think the answer somehow, you know, I guess it takes a certain time for the sound to reach. So it's a long distance, you know, it's far, far away. So essentially, it's correct. So essentially, they have a density which is really difficult to achieve on Earth. They're very, very dense. They're very heavy in that sense per volume. And so they're great labs to study extreme physics. For example, hydrogen becomes metallic at those pressures, which is hard to achieve, or basically impossible. Right now, it's impossible to achieve on Earth. So I guess before we go on to what we're here for mainly, to hear today's lecture, I have some housekeeping questions or housekeeping issues to talk about. So tonight, at the end of tonight's lecture, we will ask you again to write down the questions, and our speaker we'll answer as many as we have time for, and we'll collect them and kind of done as in the past, I guess, so you know how that works. If you can't answer them all, we will refer some of the best questions to Professor Rutledge and post them with answers on, I'm plugging this again, the new blog at mcgill.ca/science. So that's why also we suggest that you don't ask any questions actually it might be hard to come up in this field, or ask any questions that you don't want to have the answer posted on the website, okay, or the question posted on the website. It might be challenging to come up with a question like that in this field. Maybe, say, in the field of neuroscience, that's slightly different. Okay, but anyway, in addition, please complete the evaluation form and give those to the volunteers on your way out. This is close to perfect, but there's always room for improvement, and so we really value your feedback, and we'll listen and analyze, read it, analyze, and listen to it. Okay, so remember to give us feedback. And finally, if you haven't done so yet, I'd appreciate if you would turn off your cell phones and any other kind of beeping devices, Blackberries, and et cetera, okay? Because it may disturb, or any other thing that you think might disturb the concentration of the audience and then inhibit them from answering the questions next time. So on the final note, and I'll remind you again at the end of the presentation, please bring your confirmation card along next time to next week's lecture. We'll have a Canadian astronaut, Dr. Dave Williams, giving a presentation, and we expect a full crowd, and so we will have to check at the door to make sure that only people can attend that actually have the card. If you've lost your confirmation card or so, please contact the Mini Science office. The email is the middle line there, miniscience@mcgill.ca, or phone 514-398-8886. Okay? So we can then try and organize a new card for you. Okay? With that, let me introduce you to Professor Bob Rutledge. He's an assistant professor in this department, physics department. He works primarily in observational high-energy astrophysics and studies the behavior of neutron stars and black holes. Professor Rutledge was on a team of astronomers that discovered what is possibly the closest neutron star to Earth. If confirmed, it could also be the only 8th so-called isolated neutron star ever discovered. Bob received his PhD in physics from the MIT in 1997. He was a Max Planck Fellow at the Max Planck Institute für Extraterrestrische Physik in Germany. He was in a postdoctoral scholar in physics at Caltech before he came to McGill in 1994. Professor Rutledge will be talking to you today about the techniques used to measure the size of the universe, which have importance for understanding our place in the universe and how the physics of stars and the evolution of the universe plays out. You can read more about Professor Bob Rutledge and his research on the biography enclosed with your package. You'll find out some other interesting things about him. You knew I couldn't resist this, that he has actually many talents. He's also an expert on some culinary aspects in Quebec, for example, and runs a very popular website. And with that, Bob Rutledge.
Thank you very much, Professor Gruter. I'm going to talk to you today about measuring distances in the universe. So the subject of my talk in a galaxy far, far away, measuring distances in the universe. This is a very far-ranging topic. And to get to where we are today, which is fairly far along in understanding the size of our universe and how it got to be that size and how it evolved to be that size, has been several thousands of years of scientific development in mathematics and in physics, in astronomical observations. I'm going to try to summarize as much of that as I can in about 50 minutes. So it might seem a little compact, but if not, then wonderful. Hopefully it's all comprehensible. But before I begin, I gave you a bit of homework. My students will tell you I do this often. I assign a lot of homework. And I hadn't even met you, and I already assigned you homework. The homework I assigned was that you were to come with the knowledge of our distance to the sun. So I understand that you've covered this in a previous lecture, perhaps. And so I can ask you with great confidence, knowing that the answer is out there somewhere, what is the distance to the sun? Lots, 92.58 million miles, 15 billion, 15 million, 150 million kilometers. I heard 8 light minutes. 1 astronomical unit. All of these answers that I'm hearing, all of them, we can write them all down. Where do we go? If we had chalk. But we don't. Oh, yes, we go. We could write them all down. I've had 1 astronomical unit, which I can summarize. I can just write down as AU. We've had 15, is it million? I'll write this in scientific notation. Oh, 150. Very good. 10 to the 6. Very good. Kilometers? I also heard 8 light minutes. Yeah, about that. 8 light minutes. Ooh, let's use the correct spelling. And there was one more. 92.5, did I hear 8? Million miles. All correct. All these answers are correct. They're all the same distance. They're just different ways of expressing the exact same distance. Kilometers, miles, the amount of distance that light will travel in 8 minutes, and then 1 astronomical unit. 1 astronomical unit, a distance which has a very special meaning for astronomers, because by definition it is the average distance between the Earth and the Sun, and it has a very nice numerical value, 1, which makes it very easy to remember. 1 astronomical unit, that is the distance to the Sun. Let's take a look at the Sun. We have a picture of it here. Can we go forward, please? Let's see here. Maybe? Oh, here we are. I think we can do this. We'll go forward to the Sun. This is an image of the Sun. It might look a little funny because this is not an optical image. It's an X-ray image using X-ray photons. It was taken with the SOHO satellite, a Japanese X-ray satellite, which studied specifically the Sun. And it looks very different than it does in the optical way. In the optical passband, you can see a lot of active areas and eruptions. I think it's a lot more interesting in the X-ray band. And the X-ray band is also primarily where I do my own work. So the X-rays hold a lot of appeal to me. This is the Sun, and its distance, 8 light minutes away. Okay. Let's take a look at other things in the universe. We're going to start by taking a tour of the universe. The Pleiades, a group of stars right up here. They are at a distance of about 440 light years away. It's well inside of our galaxy. And just for comparison, the nearest star is only about 4 light years away, so about 1/100th of the distance to this group of stars. Okay. Also within our galaxy, objects known as globular clusters, there are about 200 of these in our own galaxy, spread around in the big old sphere, and a typical distance to these is around 10,000 light years away. So we've been 8 light minutes. 8 light minutes onto 440 light years. Now we're at 10,000 light years, these globular clusters. And they are very, very far from the center of our galaxy. Here's an image. It's not our galaxy, but I'm using it in the place of our galaxy because we can't take a picture of our galaxy from the outside since we're in it. But think of this as like our galaxy. And here is the center of this galaxy, like our galaxy, and we would be out here, right about here at this position, about 2/3, 3/4 of the way out on the disk of the galaxy, and that's about 24,000 light years, an even greater distance, going to greater and greater, progressively greater distances that we're talking about here, and that's about a typical scale for that we have within our galaxy, a distance that we have within our galaxy. And once we talk about larger distances, we go on to extragalactic distances, distances to other galaxies. This is a galaxy which looks very similar to our own. It's a bit edge-on, called the Andromeda Galaxy, and it's at a distance of about 2.4 million light years away. It's the nearest galaxy like our own to us. We can go further out, beyond that 2.4 million light years, out to 100 million light years. And here we see what's called a rich cluster of galaxies. It's an Abel cluster of galaxies. And you can see the galaxies fairly plainly. There's a beautiful spiral galaxy in the bottom right, and a galaxy which is known as an elliptical galaxy, the very top. And then we have something that's sort of irregular towards the center, a good representation of the kinds of galaxies that we see in the universe. And this cluster of galaxies is 100 million light years away. So we've moved now from a few light minutes through 440 light years, through 10,000 light years, through 24,000 light years, 2.4 million light years, 100 million light years, progressively larger and larger distances. And these seem very large, but keep in mind that the age of the universe, as you've learned from Professor Dobbs' lecture, is about 13.7 billion light years old, which means that there are distances across the universe that are 13.7 billion light years away, roughly speaking, much, much further than even this 100 million light year distance outside of our galaxy. And if we want to look closer to 13.7 billion light years away, we would see something that looks like this. This is the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. Most of the galaxies are billions of light years away that you see here. And every single dot, every single point that you see here is a different galaxy. There are no stars in this image. We're very used to looking at images like this and thinking that we're seeing stars. But the stars, well, there are stars, but the stars are in galaxies. So everything that you see up here is a galaxy, and these are billions of light years away. If we want to understand these objects, we have to know their distances. And by understand, I mean understand in a physical way. Understand how they work. You know, what? And when physicists talk about how things work, we're really talking about the energy. What provides their energy? Where that energy comes from? How does it produce so much energy? And how does it produce it to have the color that it has and the temperature that it has and the variability that we see? And so if we want to understand how these things work, we have to know how much energy they're giving us. And that turns out to be importantly related to the distance to these objects. Let me tell you how that works. So when we see an object has an intrinsic property called luminosity. And its luminosity is the total amount of energy per unit time that it gives off. So here we have a bright object in the center. I've got some arrows which symbolize light shining away from it. And it gives off a certain luminosity, the amount of energy per unit time that it gives off. Okay? That's all well and good. That's an intrinsic property to this thing. But we don't get to see that. What we get to see is something which is called flux. And the way that astronomers, us humans, the way that we measure flux is we have a little detector, maybe a telescope, and that detector collects light. And it has a certain amount of collecting area. So we'll take that collecting area and we'll point it towards the object. And that collecting area, that will be some distance away from the luminous source. So the distance of our detector from the sun is about 8 light minutes. Measuring from the Earth to the sun, it's 440 light years to Pleiades. Okay. But our detector area can only therefore capture a very small fraction of the total luminosity given off by this object. And we can figure out what that fraction is, how much energy per unit area, per unit time, enters our detector. And where that comes from is, well, we have to figure out what the surface area of a sphere is, which has a radius, the distance to the object, to us here, the observers, the detector. And so we then take the total luminosity, which is the energy per unit time, and we divide that by the total area of this sphere. And that tells us the total energy per unit time per unit area that our detector will absorb. And that is the flux. That is what we measure. That is what all astronomers measure. So that's the tool that we're given, the flux. Well, flux is nice, but we want to know luminosity. How much energy this object gives off per unit time? Because that's where the physics is. Knowing the energy per unit time is where the physics is. But we measure the flux, and it's related to this luminosity, but it's related by the surface area, 4 pi r squared, the surface area of a sphere with a radius r, which is the distance between us and the object. And that means that we need to know this r squared if we want to get out the luminosity. We can measure the flux. We want to know the luminosity, but in order to get that luminosity, we have to measure the distance to the object. No other way around it. Can't fake it, can't make it up, can't guess. We're scientists. We measure things. Okay. So that's what we have to do. Is this really that important, though? Does it matter? Does it make a big difference? Let me give you an example where it makes a big difference knowing the distance to a source. Gamma ray bursts. You may have heard of gamma ray bursts. It's one of nature's phenomena. They were discovered in 1969. First paper came out in 1972. What happened is that the United States had a gamma ray satellite, which was in a very wide orbit. It had several of them, actually. And the purpose of these satellites were to detect gamma rays in case the Soviet Union exploded nuclear bombs in outer space. That was the purpose of them. You young people have no idea what the paranoia was like. But that was the purpose of those satellites, just to see, just in case there were bombs going off, they wanted to detect the gamma rays. And so these satellites are all up there looking for gamma rays in case the Soviets are exploding bombs up there. And what did they see? Boom! Huge explosion. Gamma rays. You're a scientist at Los Alamos. You see these huge explosions of gamma rays. What do? Call the president? Well, it turns out that you, as a scientist, look very carefully at the data that you see. Here's one burst, the same burst, and the same burst detected by three different satellites. And you notice immediately something very funny. You notice that the total intensity detected by all three is about the same, which means that wherever the source of gamma rays is, it can't be much closer to one of the detectors than to the others, because that the detector that it was closest to should detect the most counts, the highest flux, but that they're all about the same. And that means that the source of gamma rays must have been very far away, much, much further than out. It must have been outside of the Earth's orbit, further than the moon even. And so they very cleverly ruled out the idea that it could have been a gamma rays from a bomb set off there by the Soviets. And they also determined that it wasn't coming from the moon, and it wasn't coming from the sun, and it wasn't coming from any of the planets that we're seeing. It came from someplace else. And this is the discovery of cosmic gamma ray bursts. But that's all they had. They did not know where they were coming from. They could have been coming from comets, or they could have been coming from the most distant galaxies in the universe. They did not know which. But they did know what the flux they detected. The flux they detected somewhere around 10 to the minus 5 ergs per square centimeter. If that means something to you, that's great. If not, don't worry about it too much. But about 10 to the minus 5 ergs per square centimeter, upwards to 2 times 10 to the minus 4 ergs per square centimeter. So they had a flux. And with that flux, we can make some very simple statements. With that flux, we can say how much energy would have been produced in those two cases. If we had gamma ray bursts coming from within the solar system, a typical distance is around 10 to the 15 centimeters within the solar system. That tells us that the total energy is going to be equal to the integrated flux times 4 pi r squared. That's surface area of the sphere again. And that total amount of energy is about 3 times 10 to the 27 ergs. Is that a lot of energy? Well, it's about as much energy as the sun gives off in a microsecond. It may not seem like it's very much on an astronomical scale. Okay. But what if they're in distant galaxies? If they're in distant galaxies, the distance to those distant galaxies is around 10 to the 28 centimeters. Those are very distant galaxies. Total energy that the gamma ray burst source must have given off, again, the integrated flux times 4 pi r squared, where r is our distance. And that means the total energy given off is 2 times 10 to the 53 ergs. Very different. Is that much greater? Well, instead of being as much energy as given off by the sun in a microsecond, it's as much energy as given off by a billion suns in 1,000 years. It's a lot of energy. So it makes a big difference. The kinds of physical processes that would have produced a gamma ray burst, say, in the cometary belt, would be very different from that which would produce gamma ray bursts from distant galaxies. Incidentally, what is the correct answer? This is where these observations came from 1972. Progress has been made since then, and we now know which of these is the correct place, where these gamma ray bursts come from. And it turns out that they come from distant galaxies. The source of gamma ray bursts must produce a huge amount of energy, and because of that, that has led physicists to think, well, what could produce that much energy? And what they have decided, what they suggest, is that what is happening is a type of supernova, where a very massive star collapses on itself, produces a black hole, which very efficiently sucks up all the matter nearby. It accelerates it to near the speed of light, spits it out in the jet that's moving close to the speed of light, and we just happen to be so lucky that we're right along one of those jet projections, and so we see it Doppler boosted, Doppler shifted to very high energies into the gamma rays. That's what produces gamma ray bursts. Might seem a little contrived. But it has to be this way in order to get the energies that we see in the gamma ray range. That is how the theory follows the observations if we know the distance. If we don't know the distance, we would not have come to this conclusion. Incidentally, this last week, a very interesting observation, the most distant object known, collapsed object, another gamma ray burst, just this last week, barely in the paper, about 13.1 billion light years away. It's a significant fraction of the distance to the edge of the universe. So that's gamma ray bursts. Another example, which I've got to throw in there, because this is the work that I spend my time on. So you have to hear a little bit about this. I study neutron stars, and neutron stars are composed of dense nuclear matter. I know you've heard quite a lot about neutron stars from Professor Caspi. What holds neutron stars up, though, gravity tries to pull them inwards, but something is causing pressure outwards, and what causes that pressure outwards are the many-body interactions between quarks. So you take a lot of quarks, you push them together with gravity, you get a neutron star at nuclear density, the quarks push back. This is a great thing. Makes sense. Everything seems to hold in our understanding of neutron stars, except for one thing. Nobody knows how to calculate these interactions to get any sort of correct description for how big the neutron star should be. We can't do the calculations. The math is very hard. We're limited in the kinds of math that we can do. It's a very hard problem. 40 years trying, still not there. But that means that different people try different approaches to do the calculations. They include different types of physics that these interactions could include. And that produces a huge number of relationships between the mass of the neutron star and the radius of the neutron star. And up here I've just shown you four or five of them. A typical radius is around 10 or maybe 12 or 14 kilometers. Masses could range somewhere in the 1 to 1.4 to 2 times the mass of the sun. So different neutron stars with different masses will have different sizes depending on how quarks interact with each other. I would like to measure the radii of neutron stars, and we've already made progress doing this. But in order to do this, we take measurements, and our measurements, we can't make up what we measure. We either have to take the observations that are given to us. The measurements that we're able to make is basically the ratio of the neutron star radius to its distance. We measure what's called the angular size, which I'll tell you a little bit more about in a moment. But that means that if we want to get the neutron star radius, we also have to know the distance to that neutron star. We must measure the distance. If we are able to measure the distance, we might determine that the radius of the neutron star is 10 kilometers, which would say, here's the physics. This is the physics that produces neutron stars. But if we got the distance wrong by 20%, then actually the radius might be 12 kilometers, in which case over here is the physics that produces a neutron star. A little bit further on, where the radius of the neutron star is 12, and so on. So if we don't know the distance accurately to just a few percent or so, the radius will be wrong by more than a few percent. And that won't do if we want to understand the physics of neutron stars. So it is important, and if we're going to get to the bottom of this, we need to measure distances, and we have to do it accurately. And as I said, it's been a long story, and I'd like to take you through it a bit, just so that you can see what we've done in the past 2,000 years. And we have quite a lot to be proud of as a species. 2,000 years is a good long time to be working on these sorts of things. But if we start, really, we have to give due to Ptolemy. Ptolemy started off suggesting that the universe was composed of us and these planets out there, these wanderers of the sky. And he suggested that, well, the Earth seems to be at the center of everything. And that makes sense because you can see all the planets moving around us and the sun moves around us once a day. So everything's fine. Oh, and then there are all these little stars out there. Those must be on a big sphere. And he seemed that it was very natural that all these things should be on spheres. They should all be in circles, moving in circles. Circles around us. Because, you know, circle is a very perfect geometric object. And the ancients, they liked geometry. Geometry seemed to be everywhere in nature to them. And so they used geometry to explain everything in nature. And so circles is what explains the orbits of the planets. Unfortunately, observations came into play. This is what observers started noticing. If you look, for example, at Mars and how it moves across the sky, you'll notice that it'll move in one direction for a while, and then suddenly it'll stop and turn backwards, and then head off back in the direction that it was going originally. This is called retrograde motion. That doesn't make any sense if Mars is on a sphere and that sphere is rotating uniformly around us. Makes no sense. So, the Greeks weren't making it up entirely as they went along, but they figured, well, maybe what's going on then is that actually Mars is on another sphere, and that sphere has a center, which is on a sphere centered at the Earth, and that sphere also rotates around that center that moves around the center of the Earth. And by doing that, you can see here is the direction of Mars relative to background stars projected on the sky. And so in that case, it would look like Mars was moving in one direction, and then all of a sudden turned back, and then went moving off in that other direction before. This is an explanation called epicycles. And that worked okay, but then you observe for a little while longer, and you find out that actually that doesn't work to explain the observations either. And so you need another circle, and another, and another. And this theory just kept adding epicycles and epicycles. There were about 8 or 9 for Jupiter alone by the time the theory was finally trashed by Copernicus, and later Kepler, actually Kepler who did the real work. That brings us now to the next step, the Copernican revolution. What Copernicus did is he suggested that instead of the Earth being at the center of all this uniform circular motion with epicycles, instead the Sun is the center of all this uniform circular motion. And that helped explain away some of the epicycles, but it didn't explain away all of the epicycles, but it did a better job. Okay. So it was Copernicus, 1543, made this suggestion. But this led to another problem. That would mean that the Earth is also going around the Sun. And if the Earth is also going around the Sun, you'd think that the stars would move back and forth in the sky. They would exhibit this effect called parallax. So now I need to tell you about parallax. And parallax plays an important part in our story of measuring distances across the universe. So it's of some importance. Before we do that, we need to discuss measuring angles. And to give an example of that, I went out onto the campus. And this is the old physics building, now Schulich Library. This is where Rutherford did a lot of his experiments. And what I did is I held my fist in front of the camera, right in front of the library. And you can see very plainly the width of my fist here, very close to the width of the library. Except for those of you who have seen my fist and the library know that that's not true at all. My fist is actually maybe 5 centimeters across. And this cupola in the library, that's maybe 5 meters. 5 centimeters is very different from 5 meters, different by a factor of 100. So why is it that when we look at the library and my fist here, that they appear to be the same size? It's because we're not measuring size in this picture. We are measuring an angle. And so what's happening here is here's our eye. That's our eye we have there. We're looking out here at our fist, or my fist, extended, and I can see the size of that fist, but then projected further along is the size of the cupola of the Schulich Library. Okay? And they're both not the same size in centimeters, but they're both the same angular size. They both have the same angular size. And this is an important distinction. Where this comes from is the ratio of the width of my fist to the distance to my fist. The width is 5 centimeters, or 0.05 meters. The distance to my fist is about 1 meter. I'm going to say my arm's 1 meter. It's roughly a meter. Yeah, I wish. And that gives us a ratio, 0.05 meters to 1 meter, which is an angle. That ratio is the angular size of my fist. And that is the angle that I'm measuring right here with my eye. That is what I see. If I go over to the library, its width is about 5 meters wide, but actually I was a distance of about 100 meters from the library. And so the angular size of the library is about 5 meters divided by 100 meters, the exact same angular size. So these are two different angular sizes. And you'll notice, here's the important thing. The angular size and the width of my fist is related to the distance to the object whose angular size I'm measuring. That's important. And it becomes important when we talk now about parallax. Parallax is a very simple effect. Parallax is the effect that if you look at an object that is in the foreground and you compare it to background objects, and you look at it from two different positions, it appears to shift in place. A good example of this is I've taken my finger and I've held it up right over the Arts Building, right over the flag of the Arts Building. And I took my camera and I took a photograph of my finger where the camera was right over my left eye. And then I moved the camera and took the exact same, didn't move at all, took the exact same picture, but starting it with my right eye. And you can see that there's been a shift of my thumb off of the flagpole, off the McGill flagpole, by a small amount. And that is an effect called parallax. You can measure this yourself right now, and I propose that we all do. I want you to all take your fist and hold it in front of your face. Got to do it. Now close your right eye, and with your open left eye, put your thumb over the McGill flag. Everyone there? All right. Now switch eyes. Close your left eye, open your right eye. You see a big old shift. That is the parallax effect. That's pretty handy, isn't it? So you see a shift from your thumb. And what you notice, this is an interesting thing too, it'll be important later. If you take your thumb and you move it closer to your face and then do the exact same thing, the angle that it shifts by is greater. So it shifts by a larger amount. Try that. Hold your thumb up, open your left eye, and then put it over the flag, and then close your left eye and open your right eye, and look at that angle. And now move it further away. I'm standing in front of you here, so you can't do any of this, can you? That's not, get your $5 back. It's unfair. There we go. And then try that with your fist very far away. Okay. So here's the interesting thing. The magnitude of angular parallax decreases the greater the distance away to the object. That's the easy way to say it. Okay. So that's the parallactic measurement. Well, that's great. That works for our eyes. It works for our thumb. We can use this in astronomy, too, and we do. Here's how. Here's the Earth right now. We can look up at the sky, and we can see this star right over here. And we can measure its position relative to background stars. So here is an image which shows a position of a star indicated by the red arrow, and it shows its position on the sky relative to the background stars. Those are the other stars in the image. And now we wait 6 months, and the Earth is on the opposite side of the Sun. And we use that image again, and what we notice is that the star has now shifted relative to the background stars. It has moved. And the reason it has moved is exactly this parallactic effect. Here's how that works. Think of the two positions where you make the observations as your left eye and your right eye. And the star is your thumb. So there's your thumb. At one point, this thumb is right here underneath the red arrow when you observe it with your left eye. But then when you observe it with your right eye, the thumb has shifted. So now it is moved relative to the background stars. Okay. So that is the parallactic effect. And what this means is we can use this parallax distance, we can use this parallactic effect to measure the distance to these nearby stars. And it works from geometry. We're actually measuring this angle P, and that angle P, that is the parallactic angle, and that is related to the distance D and this distance, 1 AU, 1 astronomical unit, our distance from the Sun. Now, those of you who did your homework are very glad, because this is very important now. You can see this, right? That distance to the Sun plays a key role in measuring the distance to everything in the universe. So this angle P is equal to the ratio of 1 astronomical unit to the distance to that object. That is the angle P. And that means that we can measure the angle P using parallax measurements, and it is with knowing the value of 1 astronomical unit, we can then determine the distance to that distant object. And the way that we have it written here now, we can use this distance, this angle P, to determine the distance to this star in units of astronomical units. And to people in Copernicus's time, that was very useful because they had no idea what the distance of the sun was. Not the slightest. But they did know that we were one astronomical unit away from it. Which is a good place to start. So, because the parallax is a fundamental way of measuring distances, we actually have a unit of distance which is based on it. Okay? That unit of distance is called the parsec. Everyone who's seen Star Wars knows what a parsec is, right? 12.7 of them in the Kessel Run? Yeah. So, the distance to a star, when it is equal to one parsec, that will produce a parallactic shift of one arc second on the sky, which means that you make a measurement at one time, 3 months later, you make another measurement, and you will see that star will have shifted by one arc second. So that is the relationship between the distance parsec and the angular shift that you see, the parallactic angle, P. So that's how parsecs became the fundamental unit by which we discuss all distances in astronomy. And I'm going to continue using parsecs throughout this talk. So we'll make reference back to it again. So at Copernicus's time, there were no parallaxes measured. They hadn't measured parallaxes, but they had good limits, meaning they didn't see this parallactic shift of the stars. It was around 10 arc seconds or so. And that means that they could then figure out at least how far away this sphere of stars had to be. And so they did the math. They converted arc seconds to something without units. It's a unit conversion in radians. And that meant that the distance had to be greater than 1 AU divided by the parallactic angle, or 2100 AU. So the size of this sphere of stars had to be at least 21,000, did I say 2100? 21,000 times the distance between the Earth and the Sun. They didn't even know the distance of the Earth and the Sun, but they knew that the stars had to be at least 21,000 times further away than that. Pretty big universe. And not a bad measurement, considering they didn't even know the distance to the sun. But then there's a key question. How big is an astronomical unit in centimeters, in some units that we know here on Earth? And they did not know that. So the next part of our story is how they get the distance to the sun in centimeters. And this is interesting. After the Copernican Revolution, there were observations made by one of the great astronomers of all time, Tycho Brahe, but it was his student... Pay attention, graduate students. His student, who actually took that data and did something useful with it, he reduced it and he determined three laws of planetary motion. Kepler's three laws. He found, first of all, that the planets move around the sun not in circles but in ellipses. Close to circles, but still elliptical. No question. On top of that, the orbits sweep out an equal area in equal amounts of time. Not a key Kepler's law here, so we'll move past that. And then the amount of time that it takes for a planet to go around the sun, as P, is related to the distance between the planet and the sun, in that the time squared is proportional to its distance cubed. Kepler's third law. And it was a simple phenomenological discovery. He didn't really know why the planets that he knew then had this relationship, but they did. So that was kind of interesting. He was also the first astronomer who was able to use the observations to predict when a transit of Venus would occur with the sun. And that plays the next important role in our discussion. But first, we move through Galileo. It was Galileo who first took telescopes, which were invented by Dutch eyeglass makers for important reasons. They were going to use them to look and see when ships were coming in over the horizon and then rush down to the port and buy up everything so they had a monopoly and people had to buy from them. They could make tons of money. And they did. Galileo, however, took these telescopes and turned them towards the heavens. And he noticed something very important. What he noticed is that when you look at Venus, you can see the light on it put there by the sun. And at the time, not everyone was convinced that Ptolemy was right, that everything moved around the sun. But what Galileo saw absolutely convinced everybody that everything had to be moving around the sun. And what Ptolemy would have said is that, Venus is on some circle which is between us and the sun. And that would mean that the sun only illuminates a very thin sliver of light that we would ever see. And that's because Venus is always between us and the sun. But because Venus actually goes around the sun, what Galileo saw is that sometimes Venus was in front of the sun, in which case only a very thin sliver was illuminated, but sometimes it was behind the sun, in which case almost the entire face of Venus was illuminated. And this difference in the phases of Venus absolutely convinced Galileo and all other scientists at the time that the Copernican universe was the correct one, that all the planets must be moving around the sun. And so we live in a geocentric universe. This is key in order to be sure that actually measuring the distance to the sun is useful for this parallactic measurement, and that the Earth is in fact moving around the sun to let us make this parallactic measurement. So with the sun established as the center of the solar system, we can now go on to use this parallactic measurement, because we expect to be able to see parallaxes in stars somewhere. Incidentally, 400th year anniversary of Galileo's turning the telescope towards the heaven this year, which is why we're celebrating the International Year of Astronomy. Using these observations, it was Newton who then derived his laws of gravity. And this was great. He found out that there was a force between objects that was only dependent upon their intrinsic properties. The masses of the two objects, mass, say, of the sun, the big capital M, and the mass of a planet, say, little m, and their separation, r, the distance between them. This is a big step, because what it does is it says that the motion of the planets is due to their intrinsic properties, has nothing to do with geometry in nature, preferring circles. It changes our understanding of the universe, because it means that geometry does not determine how masses move around. This force between the masses determines how masses move around. And it was that realization which came, you know, built on Kepler's discoveries and Galileo's observations, which then you can take this force and you completely reproduce all of Kepler's laws. Exact same laws. But now they derive from this simple equation, the force between two massive objects. That's great. But we need to get back to measuring distances, I think. In order to do this, Venus, the transit of Venus, this plays a critical role. Sometimes Venus will travel, and it will actually travel between the sun and the Earth, directly between the sun and the Earth, so that you will see a dark spot cross across the sun. That is Venus. And it was first pointed out by Scottish astronomer Gregory and Edmund Halley that if you make this observation, you could actually do something very useful with that in order to determine the distance to the sun in centimeters. The first thing to realize is that Venus does not always travel across the face of the sun. Here we're looking at the orbit of the Earth. This is edge-on. Here's the sun in the center. The Earth orbits it, of course. And Venus also orbits the sun. And that is, there's the orbit also edge-on. And you can see that the planes of their orbits have an angle between them. It's about 3 degrees. The sun is only about 30 arc minutes wide. What this means is that most of the time when Venus is at least in the direction of the sun, it's above the sun or it's below the sun, so it doesn't cross across the face of the sun. And that would mean that it doesn't transit the sun, so it could not be used for the measurement that I'm about to tell you about. The measurement that Halley and Gregory both suggested and planned for works like this. Ignore this column for now on the far right. If you have two observers, one in the northern hemisphere of the Earth, one in the southern hemisphere of the Earth, both of them can watch Venus travel across the surface of the sun. And if they do so, they will see Venus projected onto the surface of the sun at different latitudes. And then they can get back together afterwards, because remember, one of them was in the northern hemisphere, one of them was in the southern hemisphere. They can get back together afterwards, compare their two observations, and determine the magnitude of the angular separation between where Venus was, the parallax of Venus across the face of the sun. So remember the near-far effect for parallax? If the Earth was, you know, one particular distance, say some median distance, they would measure one parallax. If the Earth was closer to the sun, they would measure a much, much, much larger parallactic angle. And if the Earth was way far away, so that it was even off this view graph over here, it would measure a much, much smaller parallactic angle. And it could be so far, so distant, that actually you couldn't measure the parallactic angle. But in order to do this, you needed to have observers in two different hemispheres watching Venus travel across the face of the sun. And it happens very rarely, I said. How rarely? About twice every 100 years. So Halley died before they were able to do this measurement the first time. Here's a list of the measurements. First one in 1761 and then 1769. A second pair, they tend to come in pairs, in 1874 and 1882. And a third pair since Halley made this proposal, one in 2004, 5 years ago, and another one coming up in 2012. Do not miss it. I have here a map, just in case you're curious about where you can see this transit. In the dark shaded areas, here we are for 2012, you will not see any part of the transit. In the light shaded areas, you'll see progress at sunset over here in Canada, so we can see the transit here in Montreal, just the very end of it, at sunset. And over here, we can see the transit in progress in sunrise, if you happen to be in Europe or in East Asia. Just so you know that this actually does happen, here is a pair of images, one taken in Denmark, another taken in Australia, showing Venus traveling across the sun as it did so June 8th in 2004. And you can see here, this purple line shows where it traveled across the sun in Australia, and the green line shows you where it traveled across the sun in Denmark. And you can see with your eye indeed that they are separated, and that is the parallactic effect. We have over here also a time-lapse video, which was taken about a factor of 100 sped up, so you can see it as it moves across. But what this means is that these two observers can now compare, measure this angular size, and determine the distance first to Venus and then to the sun. And with that step, that is how astronomers in the late 1700s, determined the distance to the sun, and did an even better job in the late 1800s, got the uncertainty down to 1%. So that is how the size of the astronomical unit was determined in centimeters. Okay. The transit of Venus was observed a couple of times, 1761, 1769, and even better in 1874 and 1882. I'll mention that it was the 1884 transit that the distance uncertainty was brought down from about 5 or 6% down to 1%. A famous Canadian astronomer, Simon Newcomb, who was working in the Naval Research Laboratory in the U.S., brought that uncertainty down to less than 1%. And so that brought us to a very, very fine uncertainty for the distance to the sun in centimeters. The modern value I've written up here, we have it to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, I'm counting 9, 10 significant digits is one astronomical unit. Much, much more precise than that 1% that Simon Newcomb came up. And the reason is that we now have radar. So we're able to take big radar guns, blast them off of Venus, or the sun, but actually off of Venus, and get very accurate distances. And that has solved the problem completely. But this is how we do it with easy technology in the 20th century. The real way that astronomers did it was these very painstaking observations measuring the parallax to the surface. Well, that's great. So now we know the distance to the sun in centimeters, and we can use the parallax measurement to get distances to stars. So the more accurate that you can measure the parallactic angle, the more distance of stars that you can measure. Here's data taken by a colleague of mine, John Thorstenson at Dartmouth. And what he's showing here is the path of a particular star that he's been following. You can see here that it moves across the sky, and here it is at zero, year zero, year one, year two. And this is the proper motion of the star. It has some finite velocity, but you can also see a wiggle. And this wiggle is due to the parallax of the star. If you take out the average velocity of the star, you then get this wiggle across the sky, and that produces an oval. And that is the parallactic shift of that star. And we can see that the parallactic shift is on the order of about 100 milliarcseconds, or 0.1 arcsecond, and that means that the distance to that star is 10 arcseconds. That's what we can do on the ground now. Few milliarcsecond accuracy, which means that we can get distances to maybe hundreds of parsecs using very careful techniques with ground-based optical telescopes. It's much easier if we do this from space. The first attempt to do so from space was using the Hipparchus satellite in the early 1990s. They measured millions of stars. And what the Hipparchus satellite would do is it went around the Earth. It would do an observation, say, for example, of the Pleiades. And then 6 months later, it will have moved. And it did move. It would take a measurement of the Pleiades again. And when it did so, it would measure a parallax. And it measured a parallax, which indicated the distance to the Pleiades is 135 parsecs, which corresponds to about 440 light years. The uncertainty is 1 or 2 in this last third digit here. So it's a percentage level measurement, which is a great measurement. So these sorts of measurements get us out to a distance of several hundreds of parsecs that we can do that have been done with existing satellites. And just so that we can revisit our earlier image, here is our, not our galaxy, but standing in for our galaxy as a model picture again. We now see our distance to the center of the galaxy. It's about 8 kiloparsecs, because we know that one parsec is about 3.3 light years. That is the correspondence in physical units. And so we look out here to the location of the Earth, where I've drawn a white circle. And that white circle shows us the typical, or, a size of how far out Hipparchos was able to measure high precision distances. And you'll notice it's not really the whole galaxy. It's actually just a very small part of it, but an important part of it. If you take a look at our galaxy, you see all these bright knots of blue stars. Those are star-forming regions. And star-forming regions like the Pleiades play an important role. They contain a lot of stars. And those stars have useful and interesting properties. But before I mention that, I should tell you that there is a future to measuring distances using parallax. And that future involves the Gaia telescope, which will be launched in 2011. It's a European Space Agency telescope. And that will get us out to distances much, much further, including many, many, many more stars within our galaxy with very high precision. But the important part about that is that we're able to measure with very high precision the distances to these nearby clusters of stars. And those nearby clusters of stars contain stars that are of particular interest. One's called Cepheid variables. And what's great about Cepheid variables is that they vary. Here's the intensity as a function of time. It's on the order of a couple of days or so, and it goes down, comes back up, and goes down again. And that's what a Cepheid variable looks like. And what's great about these Cepheid variables is you can look at it, you look at the light curve, and you know you're looking at a Cepheid variable because it's variable. Okay? But more importantly, if you look at that variability, you can compare many different Cepheid variables in the same cluster, and you will find that they all have the same luminosity, the exact same luminosity. And not really quite. I'm kind of glossing over a difficult part. Actually, their luminosity is related to how fast they pulse. So what you can do is measure how fast they pulse, and that tells you the luminosity of the Cepheid variable. You are all so firmly in your seat. This is a shocking thing that we can do this. Because take a look at what we've been doing up till now. First of all, we measure the flux with our detector. And then we will measure a distance with parallax. And that gives us, finally, the luminosity of the source. We were trying to figure out the brightness of these objects. But now we've got something else going on. We've got stars where actually, we can measure the flux of the detector. But now we know the luminosity of them. That means that we can use the flux and the luminosity to determine the distance. These objects are called standard candles. Cepheid variables are the best example of such a standard candle. They're extremely luminous, really bright, very luminous, off the scale. So you can see them all over the place. And so people use Cepheid variables and this method in order to measure distances to the globular clusters within our own galaxy, which is how we measure them. Typical distances, somewhere between 1 and 20 kiloparsecs. We can also, because they're so luminous, use them to measure distances to nearby galaxies. This is a picture of the Small Magellanic Cloud. That has a distance of around 50 kiloparsecs, about twice the distance to the center, roughly 8 times the distance to the center of our galaxy, much further away. We could also use Cepheid variables, they're so luminous, to measure distances to the nearest galaxy like our own, 770 kiloparsecs, M31. Out to distant galaxies, in the Abel cluster, for example, 33 million parsecs. I just made a big jump there. Notice that? 770 kiloparsecs, 770 thousands of parsecs, up to 33 million parsecs. And that's what Cepheid variables can do for us. And then we get out to billions of light years away. And unfortunately, Cepheid variables aren't luminous enough to take us out that far. We can't see them that far. So they're not really useful much further away than about 50 kiloparsecs, or megaparsecs or so. So when we look at this, we have to use another way. Fortunately, there is another way. It turns out that in each of the galaxies that we measure the distances to using these Cepheid variables, sometimes a supernova will go off. And those supernova, very particular supernova, are also standard candles. Huh? And so we can use those supernova, and we look for them in each of these individual galaxies, use those supernova to measure the distances to these distant galaxies, and that gets us out to galaxies that are billions of light years away. So that's the story, the entire story. I've taken you from the ancients who thought that we lived in a geometric universe on through this idea that, well, maybe we're moving around the sun. And with an understanding of geometry and a little bit of physics, we were able to figure out that you could use geometry to get the distances to the nearest stars, where we found a standard candle, which then allowed us to measure distances across our own galaxy, out to other galaxies, find new standard candles, and measure distances to even the most distant galaxies that we see in our universe. And that's the end of my story. I hope that you continue to pay attention to this episodic discovery of distances to objects out there in the universe. And I hope that when you do so, that you think back to measuring these distances with your thumb. And if you don't remember to do so, I just hope that you remember enough to take your fist and hold it up in front of your face. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Bob, for this fantastic talk to figure out how far, far, far away things are.
Thank you.
Oh. Here's a little token of our appreciation.
Oh, yeah. Awesome. Nice.
So,
are we open now?
Sure. Go ahead. While we kind of...
I guess you know the routine.
Right. There's question cards up for it. So please write legibly because sometimes I have a hard time reading in my own handwriting. So...
What should I say?
So maybe if you stand here, Bob.
Okay, sure.
So the first question I have here is, the amount of time a planet takes to go around the sun depends on the distance to the sun. Does it also depend on the size of the planet, the gravity, etc.?
That's a very good question. The amount of time that that a planet takes to go around the sun depends on its distance to the sun. Does it also depend upon its size, its gravity? Well, it does depend upon the mass of the sun, but it doesn't depend on the mass of the planet. You could take another planet with a completely different mass of the Earth and place it in the Earth's orbit, say Jupiter, and it would move around in 1 year, exact same amount of time. That's true as long as the mass of the planet remains small. And by small, I mean much, much smaller than the mass of the sun. But it's because the dynamics of the system don't really depend strongly on the mass of the object. And it was actually Galileo who first pointed this out when he did his famous experiment of holding a stone and a pea off the Tower of Pisa and dropped them. And he found out that they both hit the Earth at the exact same moment. It's the exact same effect. Planets are actually falling in the gravitational field of the sun. And so, independent of their masses, they will fall at the exact same rate.
There's another great question. Why and how are Cepheid variables standard? How can all these stars all behave in the same way?
That's a really good question. Why are Cepheid variables standards? Why is it that they all behave the same way? They're at a very particular and unusual stage of their lifetime. Not all stars will become Cepheid variables, but certain stars in a specific mass range of stars will become Cepheid variables. And when they do, they have a certain luminosity. And what happens is that the luminosity is bright enough to make the star's photosphere, make its surface, expand a little bit, and that causes it to cool. And what that does is that means that something which had previously been not ionized will ionize, or excuse me, something which had been previously ionized will become combined, it will cool, and that will change the opacity. And that will make the surface drop back down, where it will heat up again, and the surface will expand again, where it will cool, and then drop back down. And so it goes through this cyclic expansion and contraction, and that is what causes the pulsing, the observed intensity pulsing of the Cepheid variable. And it's only very specific stars in a specific mass range during a short period of their life that we can observe. By short, I mean on astronomical timescales, millions of years. So that's a short time.
So next question is, what astronomical question fascinates you the most?
That's a great question. What astronomical question fascinates me the most?
There are a lot of fascinating questions. Let me tell you why I work on what I work on. I described the fact that the sizes of neutron stars are related to the quark-quark interactions. And it turns out, as I said, that mathematically it's just an intractable problem. We know the method that we should use to calculate how these large numbers of quarks, and by large I mean 10 to the 57 quarks in a single body, compare that to, 10 to the 57 nucleons with three quarks each of them in a single body, interacting all at once. We know the method that we should use to calculate it, but the mathematics is too complicated to do. And so we could actually learn a lot about these interactions by measuring the mass-radius relationship of neutron stars, and that would teach us something about how quarks work fundamentally in matter. And this is important, and I like to convey it how important I think it is this way. This means, because we don't understand how these quarks interact, it means that we don't actually understand the fundamental properties of nuclei. We can't really tell you how big a carbon nucleus is, or an oxygen nucleus, all those atoms that are filling your lungs and you're breathing them in and out every 5 seconds or so. We don't know how big those nuclei are. We can't calculate those from first principles because the mathematics is too difficult. So we need some way to understand that mathematics better. And measuring the mass-radius relationship of neutron stars will take us a long way to doing that. And that's why I do it. That's why it fills my days.
So I guess related to that, if quarks keep neutron stars from collapsing into black holes, then what replaces quarks as a material in black holes?
Yeah, that's a really great question. We don't have a very good description for matter at infinite density. But basically, if you take a neutron star, add too much mass to it, I bet you Vicky Caspi told you a little bit about this, it will collapse. And there is no force in the universe that we know of that will stop it from collapsing effectively to a point. And it's not really a point. There'll be some quantum uncertainty, and there'll be foam, and it'll be projecting outwards with the uncertainty principle. But it's basically a point. And there's nothing left there to hold it up. And so if you got to the center of a black hole, and that would be an awful trip to take, so I don't recommend it. But if you did, you would find there something with a mass of greater than maybe 3 solar masses, basically at a point, much, much smaller than myself, much, much smaller than the atoms in me, than the nuclei in me, much, much smaller than you might be likely to imagine. Something maybe on the order of 10 to the minus 32 centimeters or so.
So I guess in that context, so how can a black hole spit anything out, such as a gamma ray burst?
That's a good question. How is it that a black hole can spit anything out? Black holes cannot spit anything out from beneath their horizon. So when you have a black hole, that means that there is some part of space out of which nothing can come. That is the definition of a black hole. But we know that matter does swirl around, for example, in an accretion disk as it moves towards a black hole. Matter has angular momentum. It tries to move towards a black hole. The matter rubs against each other. It sends some matter flying outwards, and other mass moves inwards. And then, for reasons that we don't actually fully understand, black holes figure out a way to eject matter in two different directions at velocities close to the speed of light. And this may sound like a funny thing to say in a way that we don't really understand, but we see this. We see black holes. We know they're black holes because we can measure their mass. They don't appear to be anything else that we can explain. And we can see mass falling into them, you know. And when it does, boom, out come these jets close to the speed of light. It doesn't cross the horizon. The black hole has figured out a way to spit out this matter in these very collimated jets. It would be nice to understand how that works. But we're not quite there yet. And there's a lot to be discovered before we do understand it.
So I guess the next few questions are about these measurements of distances. You made a very compelling case how that actually, you know, forms our understanding of the universe and fundamental physics and things like that. So you compare the parallax of a star with respect to the background stars. But don't the background stars display a parallax as well?
That's a great question. Don't the background stars display a parallax as well? They would. It depends on how far away they are, right? So, for example, the stars that are only a parsec away, they'll display a huge parallax. But remember, the further away objects get, the smaller and smaller the parallax angle is. So if the objects are far enough away, you can completely neglect any parallax angle that they have and just measure the one star that you're focusing on now, and that will be good enough for measuring the parallax of that one star. That's a great question. Understanding the uncertainties and where we're nailing down everything.
Here's a related question. Why is velocity used to arrive at a distance?
Why is velocity used to derive a distance?
Speed of.
I'm thinking maybe this is related to the data that my colleague John Thorstensen took, where we saw the velocity of the star moving across the sky, and we also saw that as the star moved across the sky, it appeared to wiggle back and forth. The velocity of the star moving across the sky, that's just because stars move around the galaxy independent of everything else. And it's actually not useful. We don't use it to measure distance. But every star moves. We can't stop them. So what we do is we measure that average velocity, and then we have to subtract it out. And that gives us, that just leaves us with the wiggles. The wiggles are the parallax that we use to measure the distance of the object. So we subtract the velocity out to get rid of it, and then we measure the parallax to get the distance.
Next one is, again, related to the standard candle. So when the flame of a candle is off, its light is gone.
Yes.
How come the light from a star travels can travel in space for billions of years?
Wow. How is it that light can travel through space for billions of years? I'm not sure that the person who asked this question knew this, but that is an exceedingly deep physics question. Let me give you the answer that will be good enough for undergraduates and graduate students of the first year graduate students. But after that, things get a little bit more complicated. Light is a massless particle, and it does not interact with much at all if you're traveling through empty space. And so light traveling through empty space doesn't interact, it doesn't change its properties, it doesn't get old like I do. It doesn't do anything. It just continues. And because it doesn't interact with empty space, it will just continue traveling from the most distant galaxies that we see until we're here to detect it.
So I guess we're moving on to bigger questions here.
Yeah.
So if you can measure the distance to a galaxy far, far, far away.
Far, far, far away.
Does this tell us something about the shape of the universe?
Does this tell us something about the shape of the universe? Yes, that's another great question. I know that you've already heard from Professor Dobbs about the cosmic microwave background radiation. And measurements of the cosmic microwave background radiation are the best way to determine what the universe looks like, its cosmography. It's and this is the field that we call cosmology. But part of that cosmology has something to say about where galaxies should be in the universe. And what that cosmology says is if you look at the cosmic microwave background radiation, I think Professor Dobbs probably mentioned this to you, it looks very smooth until you get to very, very fine scales. And there's small ripples on it, about one part in a million. That smoothness means that matter in the universe should also be smooth. And that means that if we look around at the galaxies out there, they should be more or less distributed somewhat evenly. Except for that you'll remember that the cosmic microwave background radiation did have these ripples. There are these excesses of light from certain places. And that is where there were overdensities in matter. And there are also similar overdensities in galaxies. And we can see these overdensities, and we measure these overdensities. And so we can see what are called baryon acoustic oscillations in the galaxies, where we can see the fluctuations in the density of galaxies as a function of position. And that is directly analogous to the oscillations that you see in the cosmic microwave background radiation.
So I guess have a one last question for the moment, at least from the audience, which is, what is the implication of all this learning on our life on Earth today?
That's a great question. That's a really great question. It's a very similar question. You might ask me, why do I wake up in the morning? I ask myself that every morning. Why do I wake up in the morning? And the answer seems to be this. It means to us that this universe is knowable in its physical properties. We can look out there, and with the very limited tools and, let's face it, limited faculties that we have, we could understand what seems to be a significant fraction of it and understand it in a way that we can describe it to others, and they could go off and do the exact same measurements that we do and get the exact same results so that we can all talk together and agree that, yes, this is indeed the universe that we occupy. It does seem to behave following rational physical laws. And because we can agree on those things, that actually makes me like you a lot more. And I hope that it makes you like me a lot more. Thank you very much.
I think this is great. I think this is a great question, a great answer to finish today's lecture. I will not add any questions to that, and I'll ask some coffee tomorrow. Fantastic question. Thank you. So thank you very much, Bob. Thank you very much all for attending and for posing great questions. Let me just announce again or to remind you again to fill out the evaluation forms and hand them in, please. And remind you to bring in your cards for next week to get into the room here. Looking forward to seeing you again next week. Again, Martin Grant, Dean Grant, is unfortunately not able to come, so I'll be standing in for him again. And next week's speaker is astronaut Dave Williams, director of the McMaster Center for Medical Robotics and the Canadian Space Agency astronaut, who will be talking about Up or Down, the body's plasticity in exploring inner and outer space. I'll see you again next week at 6 p.m. Have a nice evening.